Dove Creek, a novel read by the author Paula Coomer and brought to you by KRFP in Moscow, Idaho.
Mystery, mystery, behind the veil, surprise me. Confound me. Surround me.
This is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either products of the author's imagination or used in a fictional way. Any resemblance to actual locales or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental.
All the ollie oxen free, come out from behind the tree. You and I were meant to be.
Patricia decides to take the job on the Nez Perce reservation because of the high wages and a sign-on bonus. She is learning the job's lay of the land, so to speak, and trying to adjust to government processes when she goes to Moose, the clinic's maintenance man, for some advice. In the South, he said, is food. In the South, where it's always warm, food grows all year. Even birds know to fly south. Good food keeps the body in shape for the spirit. The old way was best when people hunted salmon and the deer and dug roots. Pepsi and Twinkies ain't good, but they taste good, which is like a lot of things. West, he said, where the sun disappears, is a place of rest. The sun rests. You rest. Why people don't rest enough? That's why Indians all have big TVs, isn't it? Then there is down, Moose told me, down into the middle of the earth where lives the grandmother who gives us a place for feet to pound the dirt and who brings what we need, but only when we need it, and only if we're standing in the right place when she throws it at us. But watch out, he said. She smacks you like any grandmother would when the baby walks away from camp or gets too close to the fire. Look at what happened when the dams closed the rivers. Used to be salmon in Lapway Creek. Not anymore. Up in the sky is the wisdom of the old fathers, the ancestors. Lay in the meadow and watch the stars until daylight and listen. You'll hear answers. You'll hear answers to questions you didn't know you wanted to ask. Now, that's the old people speaking. Finally, Moose told me, is the seventh direction, the inside, where lies the heart or spirit of a human. Indians call it a medicine bag. Each baby is born with one, but in life, the medicine bag gets filled solid with hurts and traumas. He said, then, one day, a human comes your way who needs exactly the medicine you should have, but don't because there's no place for it. A heart gets tear-blocked. You gotta cry it out. And some of us has got rivers, sister. Some of us has got rivers. Moose stretched his head towards me, locking into my eyes. He said. What? I asked. What did you see? Nothing, he said. Moose's matches didn't want to ignite, so he dug in his pocket and pulled out a Bic lighter and lit his cigarette. I wanted one, but it had been years, and with the tobacco cessation program about to start, I feared my wellness credibility would disintegrate with its ashes. And what was Moose getting at, anyway? Dear stomach. Arguments on the phone with Mark, who'd moved in with Tanya. Calls from my flirtatious attorney, who I did not realize was building up to trying to get me in bed at $100 an hour until he asked to meet me in a hotel room in Lewiston to sign my divorce papers. And how on earth was a walk a circle when Moose was describing the architecture of a sphere? I wasn't asking for poetry. I was begging for realism, for wisdom. The kids had been to three schools in as many months. I felt driven by stirring internal forces I couldn't describe. I had no will, no clue how to save us. Moose was divorced with four kids. Leonard Wahoben and Ellen Barton both said I should talk to him. Moose, I said finally, exasperated and uncomfortable in the silence. What do Indian people mean when they end a sentence with "in it"? Moose shook his head, blew his smoke away from me, stared for a minute toward the noonish sun and its midwinter haze, then longed toward the crumbly parking lot edges on the ground between us. At last, shaking his head again, he looked up and said, "It's like this, little sister. The thing about us Indians is we're kind of like them Canadians. Except with Indians, if a thing don't end in A, it's probably going to end in init. Init?" Moose sometimes came to the office I shared with Leonard Wahobin, the health educator, whose desk space was surrounded by magazine and newspaper photos of him in fancy dancer regalia, basketball uniform, running gear, flanked by gold medals from the Indian Olympics, trophies from Indian country basketball. Moose occasionally poked his head inside the doorway to say, "Pick-a-tibbets, isn't it?" Other tribal members, too, always men, sat in the gray government-issue armchair across from Leonard's desk, ending jokes and conversations with the same phrase, "Pick-a-tibbets, isn't it?" Curiosity finally got the better of me. Barely 5 after 8 on a Monday morning, and already Moose had peeked in to say, "Pick-a-tibbets, isn't it?" I sucked in air and bravery. Daddy's mother ran a school in the mountains of Kentucky. I needed only to ask a question. "Surely." "Leonard," I said, "what does pick-a-tibbets, isn't it, mean?" Leonard leaned back and crossed his arms, looking slightly self-satisfied, as though he'd just won a bet. He lifted his chin to where I could see past his mustache and into his nostrils. "Well," he said, followed by another long pause, "it means one who likes to do it." It had become a regular joke, people making sexual reference and innuendo in a language I couldn't understand. Since part of my job was to investigate and treat contacts of sexually transmitted disease, or STD, I was a target for that brand of humor, and apparently bad taste knew no ethnic boundaries. More than once, they called me Condom Queen. Even quiet, traditional Amanda Alfred, our typist and phone receptionist, one day gave me a pair of condoms made into earrings, the packaging lacquer black, hand-painted with hippie-era flowers and peace symbols. "If you come to work only wearing one," she said, "we'll know what you've been up to. A." The song and lilt of the Nez Perce language sounded like what we used to call speaking in tongues back home. I kept a list of Nez Perce words taped to my bulletin board's wood trim. Despite having spent my high school education on Latin and German, I failed to see patterns in the arrangement of syllables, as though each thing had been named by sounds, which, of course, it had, since the language was passed by one generation speaking to the next, and not by written symbol. I don't know whether Leonard got tired of me asking how to spell things, but his answer was always the same. "There isn't really a spelling." So I relied on phonics. Tots Maywee meant a greeting, such as hello or how do you do. Kots Pumawa, until next time. Latas Ayet meant flower woman, which is the name Rita in Contract Health, the IHS insurance program for outside health providers, gave me after an admirer kept sending bouquets of them. What Rita didn't know was that sometimes I was lonely and homesick enough for my husband and my old life that I paid the florist myself. "I hate her," Rita told me, another woman in Contract Health said, but I hope she meant Inhatawisa, or I love you. Some words sounded nasty, pitspits for calf and tits for teeth. I had a hard time saying wa-nk-snint with my wimpy Anglo-pharynx, but identified with its translation. It represented the Nez Perce goal in life of finding full spiritual power. In meantime, I began calling people Inamlatiwa, or my friend, and jokingly called Leonard Miyats, or baby, in a manner easily interpreted as sexual harassment, but which seemed confusing to him. My favorite phrase in Nez Perce was Tots Hama. I told Leonard and Moose I believed them each to be Tots Hama, or a good man. Together they were Tots Nimipu, or good people on whose friendship I had quickly become dependent. It was November, a month after my arrival. Dee Harding and I were in my new Government Services Administration Jeep Cherokee driving to Sally Bronchard's house. Sally was in her 90s and lived in a squatty old camp trailer on Mission Creek Road, not far from where her generation as children suffered the atrocities dealt by Catholic zealots. Many were beaten, starved, forced to wear shoes sized for city dwellers, too pointy and narrow for earth-widened feet. Sally was feather-boned, her spine so kyphotic and hunchbacked she appeared folded in half, testimony to her early malnutrition. Her body length might have been 5 feet, but when she stood, her head rotated sideways like a puppet's, her smile greeting a person approximately at the waist. I walked the tamp dirt to Sally's trailer, alert to the cold pitch smell of cedar, the sun splitting fog into bright wisps between stiffened needles. Wood smoke rising like fists from a shiny tin smokestack on the house up the hill. Dee Harding, the community health representative AO, issued a soft warning to stand back in case the dogs lunged, then rapped on the pinkish metal door. Dee's hair was long and straight against her back. "Sally rarely talks around white people, except an Indian," she said. Household clutter and dog-eared vehicles were blandly regarded around the reservation, much as in the hills of Adair County, much as on the acreage where Mom and Daddy now live in Indiana. Not that the Nez Perce people were untidy, not to the degree mountain folk are, anyway, and many did maintain their homes and yards according to movies and televisions and magazines, just like people with good incomes in town. But some still followed old nomadic patterns, leaving houses and trailers abandoned for a season or two, while folks moved for work or visited extended families or followed powwows. In a 1990s Lapway, weeds proliferated and dried through and around stacks of tires and cars on blocks and hoodless engine compartments. Inside HUD houses, the T-111 siding painted an annoying shade of shirtwaist pink, dishes crusted in Rubbermaid tubs which doubled for sinks. Dusty catalogs, old newspapers, magazines, Presto logs, baskets of quilts and saliva-stained pillows, laundry in hefty bags, faded boxes of government medical gear such as roller gauze, white tape, ointments, oxygen canisters, boxes of audio and videotapes, powwow trinkets, corn husk weaving, beadwork projects, gadgets and appliances, flats of commodity food such as pork and beans, fruit cocktail, jars of Tang, Spam, discount store brands of chocolate drink powder, soft drinks, laundry detergent, grocery sacks of dried mountain teas, sage, sweetgrass, always a very large screen TV, most with rosebush branches hanging over doors and windows to ward away bad spirits. But Sally's trailer was beyond any of it, beyond the straggling habits of my Appalachian kin, beyond the faint-aired rooms of drug-abusing teenage mothers in my years as a public health nurse in Northeast Oregon, beyond the crowded cold-water migrant fruit camps in California and Oregon where I lived and worked for 2 summers in my early 20s. Sally's mess baffled even my seamy exposures and haphazard sensitivities. Dee had mentioned that Sally's father was little more than a toddler when his family was shocked awake and butchered on August 9, 1877, during the Army's famed Dawnlit massacre of Chief Joseph's band at the Big Hole River, roughly 100 miles south of Missoula, Montana. There, led by Colonel John Gibbon, a 1,200-yard-long line of U.S. soldiers and civilian volunteers shot and clubbed and then tried to burn 89 teepees full of Nez Perce women, children, old people, and a few warriors. Sally's father was swapped by his only surviving relative, a young uncle, to a trading post owner for a sack of flour during the Nez Perce's flight toward the Canadian border. He was a teenager when the trapper finally died, leaving him to find his way home alone. I tried to swallow against the dread circumstances that linked my and Sally's existences, waiting inside her trailer as she shuffled to shut the door in the cold and the dogs that had gone bounding outside, while my eyes adjusted first to the dim, then to the perversity of what lay before them. The camp trailer was barely 10 feet wide and filled bottom to brim with what appeared to be years of accumulated garbage consisting of styrofoam food containers from the weekday senior meals which were cooked and delivered out of the Nez Perce Senior Center, also sited in T-111, Prune Brown, just east of and adjacent to the clinic. There was no refrigerator, no pots and pans, no plates, bowls, spoons, cups, no grocery bags, no evidence of the purchase and preparation of food. I could not see the sink, closets, or cupboards that had to have been present beneath the deluge. Immediately to the right of my feet was a green plastic bucket of water with a dipper in it. To my left, next to a cylindrical space heater, a fraying web lawn chair, and a bed covered with a tie-tacked wool patchwork quilt in the dark, random fashion of those my daddy's mother, my grandma Hattie the schoolteacher, used to make from old clothes and kept stacked around the shack, and she and my grandpa Darnell Morrison shared at Cabin Branch Hollard on Petty's Fork Creek. Grandma Hattie marveled that even her junkiest quilts brought as high as $15 in town. The rest of the room was stacked to the ceiling with cardboard boxes. Intersecting the far wall of the room was a blunt hallway leading to a tiny bathroom from which a great stench arose. The smell of outhouses. The smell of money. Sally, chuckling, called me Soyapo, the cold distinguishing her breath, while lowering herself into the lawn chair and removing her mothy red sweater. Two further things shocked me. The burn marks on the sleeve of the sweater that easily matched the height and grate of the space heater, and the fact that she, smiling, pulled up her calico dress sleeve. "Do you want to give me a shot?" she asked. Although Dee had prepared her for my visit, Sally's annual refusal of the flu shot was legend, so I presumed merely to go through the motions of informing her about the supposed benefits of the injection for the sake of quality assurance protocols. What I got, while drawing the 0.5 cc of attenuated virus into the syringe, was Sally Bronchard's life story, in English. She told of the benevolent white man who raised her father in the pine forests of Montana in a log trading post where he watched a new kind of humanity surging westward, people whose visage and odor earlier Nez Perce likened to fish, and of her father's lonely journey to find Lapway, guided by nothing but the polarity of his gut. She shyly spoke about her own adolescence, and the miracle of her and her best friend Marjorie falling in love with brothers, hinting at promiscuity and alcoholic excess, of their years together at a bountiful place outside Lapway called Cottonwood Creek, of the brothers dying early, and of her and Marjorie sharing quarters until Marjorie got old and moved to the senior center.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
Ollie, oxen free, come out from behind the tree. You and I were meant to be.
Patricia learns the lesson of the seven directions from Moose, the Indian Health Clinic's maintenance man. She pays a visit to tribal elder Sally Bronchard, hoping to give her a flu shot. There was more. The new house up the hill with the spicy wood smoke belonged to Sally's daughter and son-in-law. Her only source of food was the senior delivery from which she ate a little at a time and saved some for mornings and weekends. The bucket contained her day's water, which the son-in-law replenished each morning. She was careful not to use the bathroom until she drank it down, Otherwise, it would be too heavy to carry to flush away her leavings. She was not complaining, only telling her story. It was hard not to continue braiding our histories, remembering an ancient photograph of Grandma Hattie and Grandpa Darnell standing beside a ladder-backed chair on which was propped a tiny seed-shaped coffin. In it, dressed in a white baptismal gown, the boy Vivian, dead at 18 months of infantile paralysis. I thought of the darkness under my Grandpa Darnell's eyes and Grandma Hattie's belly, pregnant with my daddy. I know she never recovered the loss, left her teaching post, and fell into obesity. I wonder if that's why Grandpa Darnell turned to his boarders, whether that sadness also quivered my father's development, whether Sally's family was trying to mash away 2 centuries of Nez Perce sadness by slowly killing her. "Do you want a blanket?" I barely heard Sally giggle and ask as Dee and I walked back into the chill but now crystalline daylight, my mind on Lapway and tracking down the tribal attorney. What was incongruous here? Wasn't this a wizened elder, the last traditional faction of a diminishing people? Didn't she harbor insight into the mysteries we humans are impelled to solve? Wasn't it the duty of Nez Perce youth to honor her, not tote her off to this discarded American sardine can to shrivel and die? And secretly, if family and tribe so neglected her, and where did they learn such neglectful behavior but from dominant culture, neglected as they have been, what would be their treatment of me, a white person paid to promote white traditions and, in the process, insinuating the perpetuation of more of the same? I purged myself of these questions to Dee Harding, driving fast and sharp-knuckled all the way back to town. "Geez, you're driving like a wild woman," she said. It was Friday. Temperatures projected to drop below 20, and I spewed saliva with every word. Without tribal codes to govern elder neglect or abuse, our only recourse was to convince the tribal attorney to intervene. The tribe was working on the elder issue. This was the kind of story they needed to push the handling of these situations into enforceable law. But I was new, not to be trusted, without a voice. So we parted. I to seek counsel from Ellen Barton, Dee to face tribal housing and the tribal court. Alone. I am certain Grandma Hattie looks down from among the ancestors and keeps tab on us, intervenes when she has to. Once, a few years ago, hiking the old place at Cabin Branch Holler with Daddy, I was remembering our basement house on 60 acres near Lanesville, Indiana, where we had a garden and pigs and a cow and chickens and a dog named Prince. The basement house protruded from a hillside and had a flat roof onto which Daddy had to climb to sweep away rain and snow, and which had to be re-tarred every summer, else we spent the other 3 seasons arranging Tupperware bowls and the speckled blue cold packer and the turkey roaster to catch sky water, as my Daddy used to call it, dripping from the ceiling. We had a red and green swing set he set up the night after we went to the drive-in to watch Elvis in Viva Las Vegas, and a gravel pile in which was buried a treasure trove of tiny snail shells and lizards under the front porch step, which, as we all knew, were baby dinosaurs. Each morning I walked alone a quarter mile through a trail in the woods to catch the yellow school bus. Who knows what happened to the red knit hood from the Sears catalog I had to wear in winter with only the eye and mouth holes left open. "Your mother wears army boots," a boy on the bus told me the first day I had to wear that hood. I looked and looked under Mom and Daddy's bed, in all the closets. No army boots. Finally, I asked Mom, who was sitting by the kitchen window smoking a cigarette, about which I wasn't to tell Daddy, reading a Zane Grey book and drinking a tab. "Oh, them kids is just stupid," she said. "Don't pay any attention to it." Then she put the book down and started crying because she didn't get to bring baby Delbert home from the hospital right away. This was several years after he was born, and Delbert was now 2 years old and playing on a rug on the cement floor between the kitchen and living room. "I always wished you was a boy," Mom said. I wouldn't have gotten pregnant again if I didn't think it was going to be a boy. She didn't mention my little sister Dorinda, who was taking a nap in the bedroom Daddy was making into a tornado shelter, and who nearly died at 4 months from vomiting and diarrhea. At the end of this thought, I looked down to find a cache of raven feathers at my feet. I can't explain it, but I knew Grandma Hattie had put those feathers there for me to find at that very moment, even though I knew they were just the remains of a hawk's meal. But I believe she also knew Leonard Wahoven had once told me about feathers on the ground being messages from the Creator, signs of our protection. I thought she was trying to tell me things were going to turn out, that my parents had had their shortcomings bringing me up, but I had survived it, just like my daddy had survived her shortcomings, just like Zach and Brett would survive mine. I thought it something of a miracle that Sally talked to me in English and allowed me to administer the injection. During the last minutes before the clinic shut down, falling into my warped and cracked desk chair, I described the day to Leonard Wahoven. Sally's hospitality made me feel honored but unsettled. Was the blanket question a joke? Was I rude? Was she offering a gift I'd failed to accept out of naivete? Before Leonard responded, Amanda Alfred's voice over my phone's intercom announced a call. It was Dee Harding. Sally was a free agent. She had initiated but not completed the process of relinquishing power of attorney, and an elder's death earlier in the week left senior housing with a vacant apartment. If Sally didn't mind that the place still required cleaning and painting, it was hers, effective tonight. In the quiet that followed, Leonard told the story of multitudes of Indians exposed and dying after the U.S. Army purposefully delivered smallpox-infested blankets cast from Eastern hospitals to the tribes. I wondered how I could be 35 years old and never have heard it. In an offhanded way, he said, the blanket question is a kind of teasing, a sign the Indian person has found common ground with the white person. Who knows what's going on in old Auntie's brain there, Leonard said. But a thing to remember, Indians don't take their medicine from shots. They mostly take it from hearts. What do you mean? I said, wary for some reason. Sally talked to me in English because of my heart? Well, geez, you can never tell there, Rumi, he said, doodling on a scratch pad with his twin version of my black skillcraft government issue pen. One thing about it, Indians can spot a redneck from a mile away, but they can see a good heart from 10. Weeks before, Dee took me to Sally Bronchard's. Before, I traveled to the Colville Reservation in north central Washington State to visit a nurse named Martin Levereaux, who wore the leg braces and hard brown leather shoes emblematic of polio. To learn how an AccuCheck machine checks blood glucose and how to outsmart a pack of dogs. Before I found Mr. Picone sitting at his desk staring blankly, after which he climbed the stairs to ask the doctors for an EKG and then rode the Life Flight helicopter to Sacred Heart Hospital in Spokane to finish out his heart attack. And before I set up a table at the Lapway post office for the first time to administer flu shots, Dee Harding came to my office to ask me to follow her to the house of a tribal member who was sick. I was barely on the job. I'd only had my introduction to NEPTIC and initialed all the places on the paperwork establishing me as a DHHS, PHS, IHS, NISU civil servant. I had not even opened the issue navy blue canvas nurse's bag, had not finished leafing through a stack of stale patient charts, and had not rid my office of 25 years of outdated patient information pamphlets and foot care instructions and syringes and expired sterile bandages. The only thing free of dust was a new blood pressure cuff, that and my own stethoscope. Yet one sunny afternoon, less than 2 weeks after my start date, there I suddenly was, standing at the front door to Dodie Kicking Woman's early 1900s house, a house built when Lapway was still Fort Lapway, an army settlement, an outpost securing the Nez Perce people as isolates of the U.S. government. It could have been anywhere in any of the towns in which I had lived. White siding weathered from lack of paint, a long porch, a tattered wooden screen, the community health representatives, or CHRs, D, Connie, Colleen, Virginia, tribal women trained as nursing assistants, waited as I walked up feeling once again blonde and very pale against their sea of black hair and sun-tolerant skin. Dodie was refusing the ambulance, they said. She did, however, agree to talk to the new public health nurse. Get ready, Dee said, then tapped the glass and led us inside. I knew that smell. It was the one that reliably emanated from the rooms of hospital patients with colostomies, a combination of feces, peppermint deodorizer, and stoma adhesive. Something else emerged from behind it, oddly akin to the aroma of pressure canning green beans. According to the brief history Ellen Barton had given me before I left the clinic, Dodie was known for her drinking, bar fighting, backbiting, feline approach to life. She was, paradoxically enough, honored and revered, considered a matriarch of the tribe, every year instrumental in planning and orchestrating the celebrated Joseph and his warriors powwow. She cooked for funerals and the annual root feast and helped coordinate the Presbyterian camp meetings at Looking Glass. She was also known for her months-long drinking binge after a colon rupture left her with half a colon and a brutal rosebed of a stoma. And the wages of sin is death. Dodie's living room looked like it belonged in the shacks of my dear county relatives. There was the pot-bellied stove, the patterned linoleum missing chunks clear through the wood planks, curling flowered wallpaper over lathe and plaster, a green vinyl sofa we called a duofold because the seat of it lifted, allowing it to slide forward and flat like a futon, making up into a nearly double-sized bed. Our Kentucky shacks rarely had more than one bedroom, so the living room typically held a duofold and a painted metal bedstead. When company came, the duofold, outfitted with quilts but not sheets, because almost nobody saw the use in them or could afford them, had room for three adults or four children if they slept toes to head, which they did. A woman introduced as Curly stepped from a doorway leading to another room. She let the beans burn, she said. Somebody will have to come up with something else. The woman kept her eyes down, a common behavior I was to understand. I was taught to look people in the eye because I was just as good as anybody else and was having a hard time adjusting to the difference. Curly sighed hard as though absolved of yet another burden. I turned to Dee for explanation, but she and the other CHRs were moving into the impossibly cluttered bedroom, smelly as the old chipped porcelain night pot we had to use when I was a kid. Dee, Connie, Colleen, and Virginia stood around the brown metal bedstead and a swollen reclining woman. From the fruity fragrance and pattern of her breath, the woman was in serious trouble. The rest of it fastens and fades. I undraped my stethoscope from my neck, wanting desperately not to have to clean that colostomy bag. I sent Dee to call an ambulance. I don't think I asked whether she was willing to go. And the remaining CHRs moved into action, too. Someone took Dodie's blood pressure. Someone else worked on the bloated colostomy bag. I think I must have asked them to do this horrible job. I only remember feeling surprised when it became obvious that a team had taken over. We were not nurse and aides, not white and Indian. We were humans hustling to save another human. But from above, on the rafters or the roof or from the window ledge, a 12-year-old version of me watches the adult me mark the abnormalities in Dodie's physical presentation. Pulse rapid, weak, thready, skin cool, dry, the abdomen distended and sausage tight. My girl self hears my thoughts and is cheered by the performance and the fact that I know human organ systems. Heart failure, kidney failure, no uremic frost, body salts crusting the skin like a rind of dried tears. No, the patient is not that far gone. The 12-year-old is less excited by, but tolerates my insecurities. I am used to a rural generalist practice. I can do breast exams and bimanual pelvics, pap smears, Gram stain gonococcal cultures, prescribe treatment for chlamydia and syphilis, diagnose developmental delay in a baby. But the only alcoholics I know is Daddy's brother and my sister Dorinda, whom I haven't seen in years. Do you have chest pain? Have you vomited? When was the last time you ate? When did you last pee? Is it hard to breathe? Where does it hurt? And where was my tiny red notebook full of 3x5 cards, organized by symptom and organ systems? I'd seen Dodie's pattern of breathing listed there as I memorized those cards during nursing school, and I'd seen it in newborn babies who aspirate meconium during delivery, and I'd seen it in late-stage cancer patients during my rotations of nights at Grand Ronde Hospital in Le Grand. She could live to be 100 or die any minute. "Nurse, nurse," Dodie said. "Social services never did chop my wood." I don't know what to say. It's my mother's fault. She wanted to be a nurse but couldn't pass the exam. She was brilliant in music but let it lie fallow. A mother with 5 siblings who died young and infirmed, isolated from care. A mother with misshapen legs and feet, astigmatism so pronounced her irises twitch a constant dance that made her feel as if